This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Thank you for downloading this episode of In Our Time. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In 1819, the retired American president, Thomas Jefferson, wrote to his former secretary, giving a revealing account of his personal philosophy. "I, too, am an Epicurean," he said. "I consider the genuine doctrines of Epicurus as containing everything rational in moral philosophy which Greece and Rome have left us." Epicureanism was one of the major philosophical schools of ancient Greece. It was founded in the 4th century BC by Epicurus, an Athenian who taught that the aim of human life was pleasure. His followers were wary of politics and religion, cast off their fear of death, and stressed the importance of friendship. Epicurean ideas were a major influence on Renaissance thinkers and offered a radical view of the universe that anticipated far later scientific discoveries such as Darwinian evolution and even quantum mechanics. With me to discuss Epicureanism are Angie Hobbs, Professor of the Public Understanding of Philosophy at the University of Sheffield, David Sedley, Lawrence Professor of Ancient Philosophy at the University of Cambridge, and James Warren, Reader in Ancient Philosophy, also at the University of Cambridge. Angie Hobbs, would you begin by telling us about who Epicurus was and what's known about him?
Yes, he seems to have been a very likeable, even lovable man. He was born in 341 BC on the island of Samos, and he died in 270 BC in Athens. As a young man, he studied under a follower of Democritus, who was, of course, one of the founders of the atomic theory, and that was clearly going to be the basis of his future thought. When he was 18, he moved to Athens for 2 years to do the compulsory military service, and then he spent about 15 years travelling around the eastern Mediterranean, teaching and setting up his own philosophical circles. Then when he's 34, he comes back to Athens, buys a house and the even more famous garden, and sets up this philosophical community of friends, including women and slaves, and there they live this very simple life. Epicurus says that cheese is enough to turn bread and water into a feast. He treasures his friendships. He doesn't seem to have married or had children himself. And he writes prodigiously. He worked very, very hard in this garden. Apparently there were 300 scrolls that he left. So he wrote on physics, astronomy, ethics, psychology, theory of knowledge, theory of language. So enormously prodigious output.
You mentioned the garden twice. For listeners to know how significant the garden was, his philosophical school was known as the garden.
Yes. Right. I don't know if they did any actual gardening.
Can you give us even more information about the range of his philosophical concerns?
Okay, so the primary natural good is pleasure, and pleasure is the only thing that's good in itself, and it's the criterion by which we judge the value of absolutely everything else, including virtue even. The maximum of pleasure is reached when we attain a state of tranquility, where we're free from bodily pain and free from mental cares and anxieties, particularly religious superstitions about divine retribution and the fear of death.
We'll be coming to that in a moment, but I was thinking of the range in terms of he seems to have studied physics and astronomy and written about a great number of different subjects.
Yes, we've got his... There are remnants of his work on nature, in which he talks about the physics. We have he also touches on that in his one of his letters. We've got the ethics, which we have in his letter to Menoikius. We've got astronomy in the letter to Pythocles. We've got the canon on epistemology. An enormous range.
But the centre bit was this pleasure that you were then talking about. James Warren, how much of Epicurus' work has survived, and in what form? Why do we know so much about him?
Well, we're very fortunate in the case of Epicurus because, perhaps unusually compared with some of his contemporaries, some complete works of his have survived. Angie's already mentioned these letters, letters to friends that set out, there are three of them that we have that are complete, that set out, in summary, his major teachings in physics and the theory of knowledge, in natural philosophy and cosmology, and then ethics. Those come down to us because they were cited in full by a later ancient writer who wrote biographies of the philosophers. He was called Diogenes Laertius. And they've survived through the standard means of transmission by which these ancient works come down to us. They were copied through later antiquity, through the Renaissance and so on. We also have works by Epicurus, various Epicurean followers, perhaps most prominently the complete poem by the Roman poet Lucretius that was written in the 1st century BC that also came down in that similar transmission tradition. But for Epicureanism, we also are fortunate to have two very unusual sources of evidence. So first of all, we have a more or less preserved library that was owned by a very rich Roman senator in his villa just outside Herculaneum in southern Italy. Now, this was covered in the eruption of 79 AD, and the scrolls of papyrus were carbonized and preserved in that way, and they were discovered in the 17th century. So this is a case of direct transmission of ancient texts. And this library contains some more texts of Epicurus that we didn't otherwise have, but also texts by other Epicureans, perhaps later Epicureans, including someone like Philodemus, that we'll perhaps talk about later. The second unusual case is an enormous wall from southwest Turkey that was set up sometime probably in the middle of the 2nd century AD by a well-meaning citizen of the town who decided what his townspeople really needed was an 80-metre-long, 3.5-metre-tall wall inscribed with various of Epicurus' teachings and indeed his own Epicurean thoughts on the world.
And how did that survive? When it's already astonishing that lava and that Vesuvius' work turned out to have great benefits in that case. We may find, but how did the wall survive?
It survives in fragments. It's not there intact. And various painstaking efforts have been made to try and excavate and then read and reconstruct what we have. Some of it was reused, and you can go to the village and see bits of it on the floor still lying down. So we're very fortunate in that it hasn't been more disturbed than it is.
His philosophical system, was it founded on the idea that everything we see consists of atoms? If so, where did he get it from and where did it lead him to?
Yes, his physical system sets out with the idea that everything in the world is either a body or it's void or it's some combination of these two. This isn't novel with him. There were people 100 and so years before him, including Democritus, that I think we've already mentioned, who may have originated this idea. But we have from Epicurus the first detailed exposition of his argument for this view. And it's rather interesting. He sets out from the idea that our senses tell us that there are bodies in the world. There's no doubt about that. And they also tell us that there must be void, because otherwise there'd be nowhere for the bodies to be, and the bodies wouldn't be able to move because everything would be full up and there'd be no motion possible. If you add to this two other thoughts, the first that nothing can come to be out of nothing, and the second that nothing ever disappears entirely out of nothing, plus the idea that we see things around us change and grow and decay, the idea is that those things that we see around us can't be these fundamental bodies. They must be made up of further tiny indivisible bodies, of which there are innumerable numbers of them. They've lasted forever. The void goes on forever, spatially and temporally. And our cosmos just happens to be a collection of them that's around at the moment.
It seems, David said, this idea of discovering atoms by thinking that it was like that, rather than by any examination, obviously no microscopes, obviously none of the machinery, as it were, technology, of the last 300 or 400 years, is an astonishing act of thought, isn't it? But he had this atomic, he thought that there were a great number of atoms. Did he think there were an infinite number or a finite number, and that they swerved around, they collided with each other, and they made up everything. They made up the gods, they made up the humans, they made up everything, and therefore there was no division between the gods and the humans.
You're right, yes, there's a lot in that. First of all, yes, there are infinitely many atoms moving around in infinite space. Space must be infinite because it seems simply to be incoherent. Suppose that space could come to an end, the question arises, what would mark the end? Wouldn't there be something beyond it to mark it? Given that space is infinite, the atoms must be infinitely many as well, because if there were only finitely many atoms in an infinite void, then they would be infinitely thinly distributed, so they'd never come together to form a world like ours. But given that there are infinitely many atoms in infinite void, it's entirely possible for what we see to have happened, namely that they've come together into complex patterns of motion which produce worlds like ours.
But given that the atoms obey what could be called, with a later phraseology, laws of gravity and moving in the way they are, he hit on a problem, as I understand it from reading what you've written. Where does that leave free will? If these things are predetermined and whizzing around on predetermined courses, what does that mean for free will?
Right, this was here we have a major difference between Epicurus and Democritus. Democritus had insisted that everything changes as a result of upwards causation from the bottom up, and mechanically determined motions of atoms, they bounce off each other in certain regular patterns. Everything that happens is predetermined by the laws of physics. It's like the billiard ball universe that later became familiar. And Epicurus, though he was an enormous admirer of Democritus, and indeed as a young man he called himself a Democritean, but he said that Democritus had unwittingly gone wrong here because he created the problem of determinism without realizing its consequences. Epicurus objected, that can't be right, because if Democritus was right, we would all just be helpless spectators of our own body's actions, and those actions would be predetermined for the rest of our lives. That would make morality impossible, and it would simply conflict with our experience, which tells us that we and perhaps other animals too, are capable of initiating genuinely new courses of motion. So Epicurus concluded that determinism, as described by Democritus, simply cannot be true. How does one get out of a determinism? Answer, there must be at least a minimal degree of indeterminism, and Epicurus introduced this famous, but I should also say notorious, doctrine, the swerve. That is the doctrine that an atom, when travelling in a straight line, may at no predictable place or time, very, very slightly, just to a minimal degree, change its course. And this means that although there's still overwhelming regularity in nature, there's just a fractional deviation which can't be predicted, and this is enough to determine that the laws of physics alone are not sufficient to predetermine everything that happens, and somehow that is meant to leave room for something like what we would call free will. It's a huge question whether actually the idea of atomic indeterminacy helps to explain free will, and that's a problem, an interpretive problem that's still with us. But if I could just add, the problem of explaining how a degree of indeterminacy in the motion of atoms can help to account for free will recurred in the most fascinating way after the long reign of Newtonian physics. In 1928, when Heisenberg published his uncertainty principle, it turned out that Epicurus was basically right. There is, at the subatomic level, a small degree of genuine unpredictability and indeterminacy. And scientists and philosophers threw up their hands in relief and said, at last we can go back to believing in free will, because determinism turns out not to be true. But when they came down to the question, how does determinacy in, let's say, the motion of a given electron at a given time, how does that actually help to explain free will? Exactly the same problems arose as arise in the interpretation of Epicurus.
I love it. From Epicurus to Heisenberg in one elegant sentence. Terrific. And Angie Hobbs, what's Epicurus' view of how we can come to knowledge about the world?
Okay, so we need to emphasise again that absolutely everything is composed of atoms in void, including our souls and our minds, absolutely everything. So it's a mechanistic theory, it's an empiricist theory, and it has a basic trust in human sensation and a denial of mind-body dualism. So Epicurus says we all have sensations, and he asserts, as far as I can see without argument, though David and James might correct me here, that the causes of these sensations must come from things outside the sensations themselves. What are these things that cause our sensations? And he says, well, there are these very thin atomic films, which are usually effluences from the surface of physical objects, though not always, but usually, which float off from those surfaces and enter into our bodies, enter into our sense organs. Then through a complex process, which we can return to if we want, that sort of filmic input is converted into what we call a sense impression, a fantasia. Now, the fantasia is an accurate and true report, and the same word in Greek, alethes, means both accurate or true and real. It's an accurate and true report of the atomic films at the stage they are when they enter our bodies. And we're accurate about our impressions of those films when they enter our eyes or ears.
And these films, this is emanations from, say, that bottle of water in front of me.
But that does not mean to say that the films which enter our sense organs are exactly in the same state as they were when they left the physical body, because it might have been some distance away, and the intervening medium, air or water, might have altered the atomic structure. So what we can say for sure is that our sense impressions accurately report the films as they enter us. There's still a plenty of room for error in how we interpret those sense impressions with the mind, and we can get all sorts of things wrong. We may not realise that the straight oar in water is going to appear bent to us over the distance. We may become confused and think that the rainbow actually represents a solid object that we could slide down, or that the mirage really does indicate a pool of water that we can drink from. So there's plenty of room for error at that stage, but not at the stage of the sense impressions themselves.
James Warren, can we take many Greek philosophers were sceptics, and they believed that, in a sense, it was impossible really to know anything. How does that play, if I can use that disgraceful really word, come to think of it, with what Angie's been saying?
Well, the way Angie's explained it is Epicurus' physical doctrine of perception and how that might bolster his confidence in the way our senses work.
And in the way we gather knowledge.
That's right.
That's the sort of, that's the track we're on at the moment.
But you're quite right that for a long time, various Greek philosophers, in fact, most Greek philosophers, would have been sceptics of one stripe or another. They vary from people who say we can't know anything at all to people who say on occasion our senses might be a little wonky and not quite tell us the truth. Now, let's remember that at some point in his establishment of atomic theory, Epicurus has relied on the senses. He said our senses tell us that there are bodies in the world and they tell us that things move. So it had better not be solely on the basis of that atomic theory that he then tells us that's why we can rely on our senses, because otherwise there'd be something of an argumentative circle there. So he goes on the attack against the sceptics. He says, really, if you look at how a sceptic lives their life, they don't really disbelieve what their senses tell them. No one really doesn't leave a room by the door or walks out into the road in front of moving traffic because they really don't believe the way that their eyes are telling them things look. So he has a pragmatic attack on the sceptics. He also takes on their various arguments because some of them are based on the supposition that two sense impressions might conflict. And if two sense impressions conflict, these sceptics argue they can't both be true, so at least one of them is false. And if we can't tell which is false, then we ought to be careful which ones we believe
in. To come back, just to help, and then please go on, one of Angie's examples of the oar in the water. We know it's a straight blade of wood going into the water, but we see it as a bent wood in the
water.
That's
right, yes. And you might take that as a suggestion that at least one of our senses must be telling us something that's not true. One of our senses tells us it's bent, and the other one says it's not. But Epicurus says, if you think carefully, they're not really conflicting. It really does look bent, at least the part of it that enters the water as we would say the light refracts makes it look bent, but if you run your finger along it, it would feel straight. But these don't conflict. It looks one way and feels the other. There's no logical conflict between those two.
David Sedley, central goal of his life, according to Epicurus, is pleasure. This is the thing that most people remember. Angie began to talk about it earlier on. What did he mean when he used the word pleasure? And let's just start with that. What did he mean by when he used the word pleasure?
Well, Epicurus is not really into definitions, so we don't expect him to answer your question as Plato would have done with a definition. Rather, he says, pleasure is an immediate datum of experience from birth. Every human newborn infant, probably every other animal as well, from the moment of birth, recognises pleasure as the good. and pain as the bad. So he said it's as obvious what pleasure is and what its value is as it is that snow is cold and that fire is hot. None of that needs justification. But what Epicurus, so what he contributes beyond that is a gradually refined idea of what kinds of pleasure there are and what their relative values are. And that's how his hedonist system is going to be built up. So if I could just elaborate a bit, the familiar notion of pleasure, the one that everyone experiences from birth, is positive sensory stimulation of a welcome kind, and pain is as a negative sensory stimulation of a certain kind. That's what we start from. And Epicurus calls those, has a technical term for it, he calls them kinetic pleasures. But what is not initially clear, but becomes clear, is that actually simply the simple removal of pain is itself a kind of pleasure, because although the process, let's take drinking, suppose though the process of quenching thirst is itself a pleasure because you're drinking, the pleasure, the state of having your thirst now quenched so that you're not in pain in that respect is itself a pleasant state. Not only is it a pleasant state, but the remarkable claim he makes, which earned him a good deal of criticism from other schools, is that it is as pleasant as a kinetic pleasure. He calls these static pleasures, and there are two kinds. There's the static pleasure of not being any bodily pain. If you're not hungry or thirsty or cold, then you are in a state of static pleasure. What most people think, quite incorrectly according to Epicurus, is that you can further enhance that state by adding, for example, luxuries. So if you already had enough to eat, if you have a box of chocolates as well, most people would think you've added an extra pleasure, a kinetic one, and that's an increased sum total of pleasure. Not so according to Epicurus. What the additional pleasures do, the glass of port after dinner or the chocolate, is vary your state of pleasure, but they don't actually increase it. I think this is his, although this is counterintuitive, it's his way of putting a point that's often put in popular thought by saying that being rich doesn't make you happy, it just enables you to be miserable in comfort. Merely adding, people think that you can have the pleasantest life simply by accumulating as many kinetic pleasures as possible, one luxury after another. Actually, the height of pleasure is achieved when all the pain is gone. Now, I just have to add one more distinction, which is of great importance to him. We've so far been talking about bodily pleasures, and those are the ones through which we learn the nature of pleasure. But the ones that are really important are mental pleasures. Mental pleasures are superior partly because with your mind you can enjoy all your past pleasures and all your future pleasures. You can look forward, you can reminisce. So the mind is a much more powerful source of pleasure than the body. Moreover, the most pleasant state that you could possibly achieve would be one of mental painlessness. If you get rid of all the fears you have, the fear of God, the fear of death, any fear of pain, any other fears of what the world can throw at you, then you are in the highest state of pleasure, and that is really the essence of the basis from which he develops his account of the good life.
Andrew Hobbs, can you take that on? I mean, how do we set about obtaining these pleasures?
Well, this is where the connections between the different aspects of Epicurus's writing are so important, because he's going to make it very clear that though the goal of his philosophy is this life of pleasure conceived as freedom from care, you can only attain that if you understand the nature of things, if you understand the physical structure of the universe and the nature of the gods, and if you understand that the gods have no control over our lives, have no control over what happens after our deaths, because our deaths are simply going to be the dispersal of our souls and death is going to be nothing to us. Once you've come to understand those things, then you can set about achieving contentment and satisfaction in this life without worrying about what the gods have in store for you. Now, of course, many people have not felt that Epicurus has got rid of the fear of death by saying we're going to be obliterated at death, but he thought he had. So reason and understanding are crucial here, and so are the virtues. The virtues, as we've seen, are not good in themselves. They're good as means to the life of tranquility. So prudence, self-control, courage, these are all things that are going to help us understand the nature of things, do the hedonic calculus, weigh up the pleasures and pains in our own life so we might accept a short-term pain and to get a long-term greater good and vice and avoid a short-term good because we think it would bring us a greater long-term pain, and also in order to help us deal with pain and evil and suffering in the right way and to understand that if they can be born with fortitude, and as David was saying, we always have recourse to memory of past pleasures, and if you think you're going to live, you have the anticipation of future ones. So in all these ways, we can use our rational understanding and our virtues to help us achieve this life. It's a very self-disciplined life. It's not remotely the sybaritic excess of indulgence that it was later portrayed as by Christians and others.
Before I turn to James Warren, just to sort of put a little PS, if I may, to what you were saying, Angie, he doesn't think that the gods have any have anything much to do with this, because they must be successfully happy, and why would they want to bother with us lot if they were happy, because we'd give them nothing but trouble.
Exactly. He says you've got to choose. You've got this view that the gods live this life of utter blessedness and peace and freedom from care, and then you've also got this view that the gods are concerned with human affairs and bother about rewards and punishments. You can't have both. Which is the most important belief? And he says surely the crux of your belief is that the gods are supremely, blessedly happy and peaceful, so they're not going to bother with messy old humans.
Yeah, well, back to the messy old humans here. James, would you explain the importance of friendship in Epicureanism, which caught a lot of people's attention and fancy for centuries?
That's right. So it's obvious that friendship played an important part in the way the Epicurean community was structured. And also Epicurus places a great stress on friendship as one of those sources of mental pleasures that David was talking about. That having friends to talk to discuss philosophy with, to chat over dinner, is going to be one way in which you can maintain your mental tranquility and feel happy about your own lives. Some people have found that there might be a problem with this, though, because as we've been developing his view of the good life, the idea seems to be that each person should be doing their best to structure their lives and their desires and their beliefs and so on in order to make sure that they live a life that's as pain-free as possible and as full of pleasure as possible. Now, people's friendships differ, obviously, but sometimes it seems that friendships involve putting yourself out on behalf of a friend. And some people have worried whether Epicurus can make room for a genuine sense of altruism within his what seems like an egoistic, hedonistic recipe for an individual's happiness. There's some evidence, I think, that some of the ancient Epicureans felt some pressure to give an account of this too. There's a sequence of thoughts in a work by Cicero, who is no friend of Epicurus, where he relates various possible stories that Epicureans came up with about how to make room for friendship within their good life. Some of them say, well, perhaps you start out in a sort of contract with a friend. I agree to help you out when you need help, and you agree to help me out when we need help and we both benefit. But over time, perhaps a genuine sense of other regard might develop. Whatever you think about that, it's clear that the Epicureans do want to say that there's some genuine positive hedonic value, a genuine pleasure to be had in genuine friendship, in having that confidence that your friends are there when you need them, and engaging in the kinds of activities that friends do for one another. That's part and parcel of how they will see a good, happy human life.
David Sedley, Epicurus encapsulated his core beliefs in a formulation known as tetrapharmakos. Is that how you pronounce
that
it?
That is correct, yes.
Thanks. Right, what does that word mean?
It means the fourfold remedy, and it's actually a metaphor borrowed from medicine. There really was a kind of medicine with four ingredients known as the tetrapharmakos, but Epicurus adapted it to the idea that philosophy is also a kind of medicine, namely the medicine of the soul. And Epicurus devoted a large part of his ethical writing to attempts to show how we can actually memorize and master the principles which will heal the soul. And heal is above all a fear, because fear of death and fear of God, he thinks these are the two great things that blight our lives. And here's how it goes. God holds no fears, death holds no worries. And while good can easily be attained, so too evil can readily be endured. Now, all of the content of that has already been covered by things we've said, but I'll just sort of very briefly say what they are. God is not to be feared. That's because, as Angie has explained, once you understand the true divine nature, you realize no divine being will take an interest in you, let alone be malevolent towards you. The death holds no worries. Well, this is because there's a whole battery of arguments designed to show that since the human soul is simply made of atoms, when the body is destroyed, the soul will be dissipated with it. There is no survival of death. Therefore, death is non-existence. Non-existence is not to be feared because you can't experience it. You're not there to experience it. So that's the second item. The third one, good can be easily be attained. That's because all you have to do in order to achieve Epicurean pleasure is to satisfy your basic natural and necessary desires, and those are very easily satisfied. And what that leaves is the one that we haven't really touched on much, which is evil can be endured. That's to say, pain can be endured. So that's the one remaining fear an Epicurean is in danger of having. What if I suffer an illness with intense pain? The answer is that there are strategies for enduring pain. Epicurus, on his own deathbed, described in a letter he wrote the intense pain he was suffering, but he said that was completely outweighed by the pleasure he got in reliving past conversations with his friends. So that's one of the strategies. You use the power of memory to overcome bodily pain. And the other is, this is something on which Epicurus has not been found generally convincing, at least in modern times, although he had his ancient admirers on the point. Severe pain can be endured because it doesn't last long. Mild pains are tolerable anyway. If the pain is severe enough, it'll be short-lived. And that, presumably what he means is it'll kill you. So you can deal with that as long as you realise that you're going to pass very quickly to a state of painlessness.
James Warren, what competing philosophical systems existed at that time? Was he a... Well, that's a question.
Well, in Athens of his day, there were still followers of Plato about, of various sorts, in the academy. Aristotle's school was still a going concern, the Lyceum. And then, perhaps a generation after Epicurus, Stoicism came on the scene. Again, a philosophy drawing its inspiration from Socrates, like many others of the time. But that became perhaps its major competitor for the remainder of the Hellenistic period and on into the Roman world. Stoicism, in many ways, is quite different from Epicurus on all major philosophical topics. So they believed that our world is unique, and it's governed thoroughly and maintained by a rational divine force that makes sure everything is for the best. They stressed the importance of living virtuously in harmony with this cosmic nature rather than living for pleasure and so on. So in many ways, the Epicureans and they were easy to set against one another in terms of debates or in terms of discussions. There are also various kinds of sceptics still on the scene, urging us not to form knowledge because it's much too difficult and we can never be sure about the world.
David Sedley, can we just talk about how his influence, how his teachings moved through from 300 BC into the Roman age and what it encounters, what it takes to itself and so on?
Well, the Epicureans were regarded in their own day as very conservative in the sense that they were thought to be very committed to the word of the founder of the school. It wasn't actually just Epicurus, but Epicurus and his three leading associates, Polyaenus, Metrodorus, and Hermarchus. Their words were treated as kind of canonical. So the outside perception was that the school didn't really adapt very much. It simply went back to the Epicurean Gospels. But the reality is very different from that. It did actually, it moved into the Roman world, as particularly around, starting around, say, around 100 BC, the power of Rome in the Mediterranean had grown. Athens, which had been where the centre for philosophical schools, was in decline. And Philodemus, who James mentioned earlier, is a very good example of the way that Epicureanism adapted itself to the Roman world. Philodemus had studied and lived and worked in Athens, but he, sometime in the early 1st century BC, he moved westwards, set up a school in the Naples region. This was probably at Herculaneum, and there that was a very well chosen spot because it was where wealthy and powerful Romans went to spend their leisure time, Campania, the area around Naples. And there he won the ear of many influential Romans, for example, Piso, the father-in-law of Julius Caesar. Horace and Virgil, the poets, had Epicurean backgrounds in the Naples region at that time. So we could get a very clear sign of not only of Epicureanism adapting to different geopolitical circumstances, but also adapting itself to the cultural interests of the Roman world. We see Philodemus wrote many works on aesthetics, for example, which had not been a preoccupation of the early school.
His most important influence was Angie Hobbs. Was that on Lucretius, and if so, why?
I don't know why Lucretius felt that Epicurus spoke specifically to him, but yes, De Rerum Natura, on the nature of things, is it's a work of genius, I think. I mean, Cicero, who, as we've heard, is no friend of Epicureanism, but he said it has elements of genius in it. Ovid calls it sublime. I mean, it is the most fabulous hexameter poem. The power of its imagery, the vividness of the depictions of human fears of death and anxious human squabbles over power and wealth. He really, really moves you to want the kind of salvation that he believes Epicurus is offering.
Is he paying tribute to Epicurus throughout this poem? Do we know?
No question about it. I mean, he treats Epicurus, I would say, as a quasi...
He says he was a god.
A god. I mean, of course, that's a loaded thing to say, given what the Epicureans felt about the gods. So it's no surprise to me that when the Renaissance, as we'll hear probably in a bit, rediscovers Epicureanism, it does so through Lucretius. It's a poem that really grabs you. And the rhythm and the cadences of its verse, and it's just
talking about the nature of things.
Yes, so absolutely.
It's talking about everything, really.
Yes, I mean it is. Yes, it's also the power of the arguments. And we owe to Lucretius our understanding of certain key elements of Epicureanism. He may well have, I'm sure he did get them from Epicurean texts, which are lost to us. But we only know about the swerve that we were hearing about earlier, which may or may not create a space for free will. We only know about that from Lucretius. The intricate mechanism whereby the images, the filmic atomic films that enter our sense organs get transformed into sense impressions, that very intricate mechanism is from Lucretius.
Did the growth and arrival and spread of Christianity have an effect on Epicureanism?
It's hard to tell whether it had an effect on Epicureanism, but they weren't, I think, comfortable bedfellows. It's very hard to see much common ground between these two views of the world or views of human condition. We've already touched on more than once the idea that Epicurus says we should be made confident not in the knowledge that this life is all that we have, and when you die, that's it, that's annihilation, and that's a good thing for you to
and
come to terms with.
And the gods will not interfere in
Absolutely.
Human affairs. That's another difference.
They don't interfere in human affairs, they didn't create the world, there is no retribution for doing wrong, there's no reward for doing right in this life.
So every basic tenet of Christianity...
More or less.
...is challenged Epicureanism and the other way around.
Absolutely. There are many other ancient philosophies that are much more friendly to that kind of Christian outlook. Platonism, for example, had a much easier ride
Did this, therefore, was this one of the main factors in the ebbing of the influence of Epicurus at that time in the early years of the AD years?
I think it's quite possible. We know that, nevertheless, various ancient texts that talk about Epicureanism continued to be copied and read, otherwise we might not have had them at all. But there was, I think, an unease dealing with Epicurean thought.
I've got to push forward about 1,000 or 1,200 years just for the final question. When did Epicureanism re-emerge in the West, in the knowledge bank, as it were, and become effective again? Could we go around the table? Start with you, Angela.
In 1417, Poggio, who was a former papal secretary of the now disgraced Pope John the 23rd, had time on his hands, and he went travelling in Germany, visiting the German monasteries, searching for the pagan texts that were his private hobby. And we think in the Benedictine Abbey of Fulda, he just by chance pulled down a copy of De Rerum Natura, which had been gathering dust for hundreds of years, and he was the man who reintroduced it into the West. And initially there was a very interesting debate actually between Christians and followers of Epicurus about whether Epicureanism could be assimilated into the Christian faith, and More and Erasmus have a very fascinating discussion about that. But it's really with the rise of the new science at the end of the 16th and in the 17th centuries that you get the philosopher scientists like Bacon, Galileo, Gassendi in France thinking that Epicureanism was extremely congenial to the mechanistic theories of the universe that they were developing.
James Warren, do you want to add to that?
No, but I would add just that even in the 17th century, when there was more of an interest, perhaps as a result of Gassendi's commentaries on Diogenes Laertius and so on, even then, I think there was an attempt to try to accommodate some idea of divine causation in our cosmos within the Epicurean system. So they weren't going to revive this wholesale. There were still qualms that were strong enough that meant that they really had to qualify what was the unadulterated Epicurean worldview.
Gassendi says that God created the atoms and God has ordained all the movements of the atoms.
David Tudley.
Well, not much to add to what's just been said, but it is worth saying that Gassendi, who's just been mentioned, is a particularly important figure because not only is he a leading scientific and philosophical thinker of the 17th century, but he was also a scholar of Epicurean texts, and he brought the two together, as no one previously had managed to do.
Well, thank you very much, Angie Hobbs, James Warren and David Sedley. And next week we'll be talking about Ice Ages. Thank you for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 Arts and Discussion programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.